Hello and welcome to the Home Assistant Podcast. My name's Phil. Joining me as usual, I've got Rohan. And today we're joined by Alistair. How's it going?
Hey guys, really well. Thank you.
Welcome to the podcast. Whereabouts are you joining us from?
I am in a village just south of York, so north side of England.
Nice.
GMT, nice. Right in the middle time zone between you two.
Excellent. Yeah. Always love going back to the UK. All right, as usual, this episode of the Home Assistant Podcast is sponsored by Home Assistant Cloud by Nabucasa. Easily access your local Home Assistant instance remotely for a small monthly fee that supports the Home Assistant and the ESP Home project. Configuration is done via the user interface, so no fiddling with router settings, SSL certificates, or any YAML. All right, Alistair, let's maybe give yourself a little bit of an intro. So you're right on GMT, right in the smack bang between us. What's led you to Home Assistant? How did you get here today?
So as a kid, I mean, we start right from the beginning, I always just took everything apart, bikes, whatever, had to understand how they worked. Probably yep. This resonates with quite a few people who are into home automation. And then these things called computers came along, and although you took them apart, you didn't really understand how they worked. So I ended up doing a degree in computing, learned how they are, career in IT. Yes. And throughout all of that, to be honest, you do everything in IT and you sort of press buttons on a browser or whatever, and something else happens in software. And I didn't really I was always fascinated by sort of the switch from software to hardware. You press a button and something in hardware happens, but it was never really attainable and never really in the kind of work that I did. And so for me, the whole thing really started with the Raspberry Pi when that came out. I was fascinated with it as a, really small, low power device that you could turn on and just leave in the house running 24/7. And that was the first entry point into it. I mean, I bought the Pi, didn't really have anything to do with it, probably like most people. And then I started, the whole thing started with music for me, really. So I had, I started buying the Hi-Fi Berry boards. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they're little Hi-Fi boards piggyback onto the Raspberry Pi. So, and you can buy them in all different forms. So some of them have built-in amps. Some of them have like 3.5 mil jacks into it. And I also then, but it was in the backdrop of, we were at the point of, do we buy Sonos or not? That was probably the, and so I costed up Sonos and gone, wow, that's a lot of money.
I was going to say, don't do that. Just buy Sonos. You don't do the costing. You just buy one Sonos and then you let that be the gateway, right?
So I did the costing. I went, wow, that's a lot of money. And decided, said to my wife, there must be a better way of doing this, and talked to some colleagues and got pushed onto it. It was an interesting one, the LMS project, so the Logitech Media Server. Now, I know you've done many sort of, failures of the cloud and what have you, and it was a great example of a commercial company who decided to, sort of deprecate a product, and at the same time, they open sourced the software. So squeeze light and honoring. So you could basically install the software, and it was in the days where you'd rip your whole sort of CD library onto FLAC, put it on the thing. So you kind of had a server, and then you had these clients, these little squeeze lights. And I had we've all got like sound bars in the house. I had a stereo in there. Yeah. So basically started just dropping pies left, right, and center around the house with the central server one running, which kind of became Keys Home Assistant. And I could play music, and it was just, mind-blowing. And I'd done it for essentially what was a few pounds, considering what the Sonos would have cost. I was so pleased with it. And then there was this kind of environment around, people had done the add-ons to it, so you could do radio add-ons, so suddenly I could just stream zone streaming of radios and everything, and at that point I was just totally hooked. So things moved on then. So I've got a computer on 24/7, and I'm starting to, I went and bought a load of Toya smart plugs. At the time there were Toya, just basically 39, as we know today. And then there was, they were cloud connected, and I put them on, and we had a few lights, and we're thinking, oh, this is okay. But at the same time, I was just browsing on the web, as we all do, and I found this thing called Home Assistant. I think I was doing like searches for integration with Toya and that was it. I was in pretty much the early days, but I got it up and running in an hour or so. Started connecting up these plugs, and from there, I was fully in the rabbit hole. And we should sort of, I say this to anybody who I sort of start talking about Home Assistant for, there should be a health warning on this. Yeah, really should. If you are of a certain nature or personality, you know, and you get into this, it's just, it takes over everything. The hours I have spent, and I've loved every single minute of it, but I think, you know, people should just be aware, you know, if you're of that kind of disposition and you kind of into this stuff, this is the biggest rabbit hole you'll ever go into in sort of IT.
It's expensive and it's addictive.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. On the expensive side, if you look at, like, by not buying Sonos, and I know we're not kind of into the world of, I saved everything that I've ever spent on Home Assistant. And I'd actually say I've not spent a fortune on it. I'm really, really pleased with what I've spent. The smart plugs and everything, I'd say, have managed to pay for themselves without a doubt in terms of what they save. So, you know, you can do it on a budget, but the sort of the word of warning is, like, I typically, you know, when you're browsing AliExpress or whatever, I'm tended to buy the cheapest one because most of the time you're thinking, is this worth doing?
Mm-hmm. Is it going to work?
100%. Yeah. And I buy the cheapest one. And I got caught out once with a Reed switch on a garage door. And I just, for the life of me, it was like, it wasn't working. Saying the garage door was open when it was closed. I'd go and put a multimeter on it and it appeared to be working. And then long story short, I changed it. I bought some slightly more expensive Reed switches and it worked perfectly. And I'd pulled all the wiring out, assumed I had a break in it. So you can, you know, when we're sort of at the $1, you know, £1 end of the small little bits you're buying, maybe you want to buy a little bit better or something. I've got caught out. But it is always worth the time, you know, you don't really want to admit how much you spend on this stuff. So I've tried to always.
Especially when you're doing, when you're ripping out wires, start all over again. And then you're like, oh, what's the point, right? Like, So on that, you said that you think you've saved more money than you've invested into Home Assistant. How do you think you've been able to achieve that?
Without a doubt, just from the energy management. So we'll come on to it. The heating system I have, and that will go into that. That is just massive. But even though even small things like turning the tellies off, I've got one telly, an older one, first the one behind it. That one is a really old LED, and it, even on standby, it's like 16, 17 watts on standby. And when you turn it on, it's even more, you know, like compared, I've got a much bigger TV over there, and it uses probably a third than that one. So just turning on, just using smart switches and turning them off or getting Home Assistant to turn them off probably pays for those plugs as they are.
Yep, easily, yeah.
So, and we will get into the big savings later on, and they are really, really tangible to me.
So, I guess, what are you running Home Assistant on today? Like, is it still the Raspberry Pi, or have you had to upgrade? Because everyone's sort of, it starts with the Raspberry Pi, right?
Well, this is a bone of contention for me because I did upgrade to a Raspberry Pi 4 with an SSD when you could get hold of them when they were cheap. And I would say I've got a pretty extensive implementation. I got a lot of devices on there. It's doing a lot of things. And I've never, ever had a problem. Never had a problem with, you know, latency of it turning on lights or anything. Now, I realize I've got a distributed system, but we'll probably go into the architecture. But I have no intention to change it whatsoever. And I've got Frigate running on there now. You know, I've got four cameras streaming and it's doing presence detection. So I often think, and I know I've heard on the podcast people, and particularly at the moment you see on the Facebook groups and everyone is going, oh, I'm upgrading to a Nook or I'm going, you know, because my Home Assistant is running slow on my Pi. And I'm like, well, it must be masking something because mine's doing a lot and it's absolutely fine. So, You get back into, if you're not careful, you know, some of these things, I did a sort of back fag packet kind of calculation. I think my Home Assistant is about £20-25 a year to run. That's kind of dependent on your electricity tariff and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you, as soon as you start, you know, I know you're plenty of guys running racks of servers in there. In their basements and what have you. And I was like, we're sort of losing the point of it here. One of the reasons I see Home Assistant is to, you know, it should save you money, really. It's be all and end all, but it's one of the byproducts that you hopefully gain from having a smart home.
Yeah. No, that's fair. So I know there's. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I'll just finish on the music thing because that was like. And then I moved on to, as we've all done, you know, no one rips CDs or whatever. And then the last bit in terms of like software that I used, I then found, LibreSpot, but specifically Spotify. I don't know if you've seen that on. So It's basically a library to run that integrates with Spotify. And I've got some of those pies are in some pretty hostile environments because I've got one in the polytunnel, one out wherever. And I've in, I reckon, 8 to 9 years, I've never had a single failure of either the Hi-Fi Berry boards, so the audio boards, or the Raspberry Pi. So in terms of bits of kit, they're fantastic, you know, absolutely fantastic. So I would
That's awesome.
So I kind of was like early on the, I know there's been the kind of music theme to Home Assistant, but I sort of started with that, and I was years ago. And as you see later in terms of the setup I've got and what I've done with, say, presence detection, the fact that I had a Raspberry Pi in sort of all the living rooms defined the architecture and direction that I went with Home Assistant, just because I had a Pi in there and I was going to use as much as I could at that. So I think a lot of the discussions are, well, we'll discuss it in presence or whatever, but a lot of the discussions and stuff that you have were defined for me early days just because I used the Pis as a kind of music direction.
And so with this like music direction through the Raspberry Pis, you've essentially got whole house audio that you would get with a Sonos high-end system, but running through Raspberry Pi. So it's all synchronized. You can shoot music around to different rooms as required.
Absolutely. So you basically use a combination that at the bottom end, there's a thing called Pulse Audio that you put, which accepts audio streams from many and just sort of accumulates them. And then I use a combination of Spotify, Snapcast, or Snap Server, if you're familiar with that. Yep. So that does the multi-room audio for Spotify. And then Spotify itself is the mechanism to do it. And it is absolutely rock solid. And I know you've got kids, Phil, that are young. Like when I got into this, my kids were teenagers. And you know, if they went to their phone and hit play on Spotify and it didn't, you know, kick off in 3 milliseconds, you know, the world would stop evolving. It was a kind of a, and so they were kind of at this, you know, they went to college where everything was high-end stuff. The internet was like, you know, mega. So I've sort of tried as best as I can to provide an environment that was somewhere on a par with that. And at least with the sort of streaming music thing, you know, it was absolutely and is absolutely rock solid. And I would say, you know, up there with Sonos in terms of, I would expect the kind of experience that you have. You just hit play and it every single time. So
yeah, that's fantastic.
I don't know why. I think I always expected, like when you're running it off of a Raspberry Pi, to be not a lower quality, but I just assumed it would suffer a little bit from, like, in terms of just performance, right? Or like even latency processing, those kind of things when you're punting music through there. But because I have actually seen those the Hi-Fi Berries that you use there, right? On the Raspberry Pi. And I'd looked into that a while ago to be like, oh, can I make my own smart speakers kind of thing, right? And that's what it always came down to. I'm like, I don't know. So it's actually good to hear that it's as performant as it is.
It is. I don't know how much the Hi-Fi Berry boards sort of take any of the processing, if any, off. I mean, we'll sort of get into, and I know, Phil, your aversion to Wi-Fi and everything is beyond it. I'm on Wi-Fi. But before that, one of the things we did when we moved into the house was before we put some, perhaps one of my one of my tips is, like, we moved in and there was no wiring for anything. There was no Cat5 in anywhere, no alarm system in. So I ran cables all around the sort of at the ceiling level. And then that was before we put some coving in. So if you don't have coving and you don't have Cat5, put all the cabling in before and then it all gets covered up. So one of my prerequisites for these is that all of the Pis that stream music, particularly simultaneously, they're all on a wired network. So they're all on switched 100 meg, which I think is a big part of, if people are experiencing problems, a lot of them are going to be network, particularly when you're doing simultaneous streaming.
Yeah, I think even with Sonos, if you, like, Sonos runs its own separate Wi-Fi network to do all the similarities, right? And even then, like, Sonos can struggle. And I can't remember if once you then plug by default, it will use your Wi-Fi network because that way you can just have the speakers around separately, but to get the best performance out of it, and if you do find that your Sonos system is, you know, getting a bit of out of sync, you can actually plug one Sonos speaker into an Ethernet jack, and then it will create its own Wi-Fi system around itself, so that, you know, you get better quality. So it's certainly, yeah, Wi-Fi can be a performance hit for even just music streaming around the house, definitely.
Yeah,
yeah. I kind of come from the, I mean, I have tales of, my whole view of Wi-Fi is, A, it's a lot more reliable and robust than you think. We used to go, we get flown off to these, you know, sort of every year, and you'd kind of learn all the new products or what have you. And we'd be in some freezing cold air conditioned, you know, huge amphitheater. There'd be like 5,000 people, and on would come, you know, the executive VP of something or other saying, hey, we've got the new version of beta, whatever. And, you know, simultaneously 3,000 laptops would open up, and you get that hue of 3,000 laptops being opened up. And
yeah.
And everybody would start to download this thing of X gigabytes, and it worked, you know. So to a certain degree, as we move on, all of my devices, if they're not on wide network, they're on Wi-Fi. I've got nothing Z something or other. And it's a little bit of a, I stayed away from Z everything just because I didn't really understand it, and I fully understood Wi-Fi. And, you know, and that's been my, and I've gone around and sort of reutilized a load of the old, you know, you get the old routers that you get as you upgrade and suppliers and all of that. And so I was flashing those with OpenWRT and just using those as Wi-Fi access points around the house. So I just went down the route of, I will have rock solid Wi-Fi throughout the house, and that
will work.
And to be honest, it has. And it's a technology I understood and had trust in. So it's worked really, really well for me. So I kind of moved on from that because we did the smart plugs. And then it's interesting because as I sort of reflected on coming on here, I thought, how do you sort of describe your journey? And a lot of the time, so I kind of got it in my mind, you've got like pre-Home Assistant and post-Home Assistant. You've obviously, you know, when you move somewhere, and I should sort of start off and sort of say, I was really, really lucky in the fact that I moved here, I own the house, or, you know, we live and we own the house, we don't rent. And I knew kind of for a load of the things that we've got, we were going to live here for a long, long time. So it was easy for me to invest in and get involved within the project because I knew I was never going to rip anything out, which meant I could dig up, you know, the driveway and put cables in if I needed to. It was worthwhile doing. So that.
Right.
But then you've got this sort of pre-phase. I'm sure this must resonate with a whole lot of people where you've got into Home Assistant and you suddenly think, oh, I've got all these things I need to connect. So I went down the whole route of lights went in first. And one thing I bought, so when we moved in, I'd wired up a traditional alarm system, you know, so the infrared things in with a box on the wall, that sort of stuff. And at the same time, just around the same time, connected with a K. So I don't know if you've seen or heard of them. So they make specialized alarm panel boards that replace the existing one.
Yeah.
So I waited for the pro version to come out with a wired Ethernet connection, and I put that in. So, and that was really, really important because I suddenly turned the alarm system from this binary, really thick on-off kind of device into a key device for me actually using Home Assistant. I went plug mad and put everything in. So I was lucky sort of from a pre-Home Assistant, most of the lights that we use in the house are plugged in. So they're standing lamps. We don't really use the sort of the wall light switches. There are a few we use, but not many. But that meant...
Yeah.
I could obviously put smart plugs on those and control them through Home Assistant. And if I did it intelligently, we were there. And then I sort of at the same time, then I never really had heard of ESP devices, you know, 286s or 8266s or anything like that. So and this word Tasmota kept coming up. And that was the light switch moment when you realize, I've got this now. The Toya stuff was good. It worked across the cloud. There was a bit of latency, but then I sort of understood the whole subsystem, if you like, of Tasmota, and then ESP Home wasn't really as big as Tasmota at the time, and
that's
the
right,
profiles, guy Blackadder, I owe him a beer, you know, because he had written the profile for the plugs that I had that actually also did energy monitoring, which was really useful. I tried to flash them with ESP Home, and I was lost in a world of pain trying to edit some YAML files, trying to work out how to get this plug to work, and then, you know, so I was kind of committed on the Tasmota side more by fate than anything. One's better than the other.
And are you still on that train?
Yeah, today? I'd say like so. I mean,
Tasmota,
I have. Oh, yeah. Everything's Tasmota now. So every device I have is local. And if it can be flashed, it has been flashed and it sits there and runs locally. And then I had our post box is sort of away from the house. So I even, you know, I sort of had a bolt thing and a little micro switch. So when that came up, I could actually tell when the the post box had been opened, and then the gate bell as well. So there's a, you know, on an intercom system, and this is perhaps another tip, I struggled for years trying to weigh a reliable way to catch when the doorbell had been rung. Mm-hmm. And it was mostly because all intercom systems, as far as I can make out, are all sort of AC, like mine's 24 volt AC, which is kind of difficult to do anything with. And in the end, I was trying out, I like took the box apart and tried to sort of make up my own switch, if you like, mm-hmm. so that when the button was pressed, it made a contact, and there was all sorts of hot glue solutions, and none of it really worked. Yeah. Until I got to, I found you can get these tiny little AC relay boards off AliExpress mm-hmm. again or whatever. So of course, anybody who's trying to integrate stuff on like intercom stuff, so it's basically you plug in the sort of the AC contact. So wherever the buzzer rings, if you like, those AC contacts go live. You put them into the relay one end, and it flipped just a relay the other side. So I suddenly now, and I've got, you know, I had an ESP device, so I've got GPIOs, and so now I can suddenly catch reliably the doorbell going. So there was another one. That was sort of my pre-home assistant phase, and I did the garage doors as well, similarly the same thing. I sort of ran wires, had an old Pi, used all the GPIOs, so that I had sort of reed switches at the bottom to connect it, and essentially a board with relays that were just mimicking the button pressing of, you know, if you actually open the garage door. And that kind of had the advantage that, and it's pretty been one of my ethoses, that most stuff that you integrate, it works as it used to, as much as it works as well with Home Assistant. So that kind of gets you out of problems when things fail, if you like.
Absolutely. Yeah,
the reliability factor, I think, there is huge, right? So,
because I have I automated my garage door not too long ago. And same thing, I got a garage door opener off Amazon, which integrates with HomeKit, but it's just two wires, right? It flicks a relay. So that means all the fobs, all the remotes in the house still work, right? So Home Assistant is just an add-on. It doesn't interfere with anything else, and I think that's a bonus.
Yeah, it's exactly my ethos across all of this, because, you know, we have failures, whether we like to admit them or not, within our own sort of smart homes, and the failures can be really, really painful unless you've got, you know, the actual sort of original backup 100%. For it as well.
The last thing you want is Home Assistant to be a single point of failure in your home.
Yeah.
Like if Home Assistant's offline, nothing works, right? That's the worst case scenario.
Yeah.
So out of everything you've talked about, I mean, everything you've talked about and everything you haven't yet, how local versus cloud dependent are you, would you say?
Oh, I'm okay in that. So we'll move on. I have a Powerwall, which we'll talk about in a bit. So I have a Tesla Powerwall. So I am, if the power drops here, everything stays up pretty much. So all the lights work, all the switches work, everything's Tasmota locally, the heating system and everything. So I have it's quite interesting because, like, the Powerwall itself has a local API, but if you use the app on the phone, it's going to the Tesla cloud and whatever and then coming back down. But as far as I'm concerned here, if you were to knock the Wi-Fi off now, or rather my broadband, in terms of the house, everything would continue to work. Now, I've kind of, some of that's by luck, some of that's by design, if you like. And if I was sort of moving forward, I would make sure by design everything is. So kind of anything that had a cloud element to it, I sort of have stayed away from it. And I suppose it makes an interesting story, like in this pre and post Home Assistant. So we did the kitchen up, and then we had a big window, and we sort of waited a little while and thought, oh, we actually need a blind for the window. It's a big window. We weren't sure whether we wanted to. And you kind of go in this pre world, you just hook up what you've got and you work around the problems that you've got. The money's invested, you just got to get it work. And then you go to we've got to buy a blind, and you're there, you know, with your better half, and they're kind of going through and go, oh, I quite like this one. And I'm sure we've all done it where you're there typing away like furiously, doing Google searches, going, does this integrate with Home Assistant? And you're going, 100%. Oh, I quite like that one, but this one might be good, you know. And apparently, for some bizarre reason, the choice of the blind was going to be based on the aesthetics of the blind rather than its ability to hook into Home Assistant. So I just find it amuses me exceedingly now when we're sort of in the post-Home Assistant world, and your choice of doing things is based a lot on whether it actually works with it, or either the degree of difficulty or the expense of getting this thing integrated into it.
For me, I actually find that a little bit good in the fact that it actually reduces the field of options. Like if I'm looking for a light switch or something, right? Like if it doesn't integrate with Home Assistant, then I don't care about it. Or if I see something on AliExpress and I go, oh, that looks cool. Actually, does it work with Home Assistant? Then no, I'm not interested. Because otherwise, I just end up in a situation where I want to integrate something and it doesn't integrate and I'd be frustrated. So
the problem with that is, and I agree with that ethos, but the problem is when you're buying some things that are being chosen for the aesthetics in the room as opposed to, you know, any other. And at that point then, I don't, you know, funny enough, I don't have an overall say on what gets bought. Like,
yeah. Well, I think the other thing is too, depending on what it is you're buying too, there's sometimes your choices are cloud or cloud, right? If you want somewhat good, otherwise it's just going to be, you know, you're stuck with something that you don't really necessarily want, right?
An interesting story on that. In the end, we ended up with a Somfy blind, the Somfy motor.
Yes, yep.
And whilst we were going through this process of choosing the blind, you know, I'd sort of managed to see, yeah, you could buy a bridge, but the bridge was £200. I'm like, okay, you know, I'll just swallow that. Yeah. I've got no choice. We're having this blind. And in the background then, after the blind was chosen, it was ordered, I've just spent ages thinking there must be a better way to do this. And I came across Pi Somfy, which was just another, I owe that guy a beer as well. You know, he'd actually, so you order off AliExpress the little 433 megahertz sender.
Yeah.
And he'd even then, now Somfy, for their infinite wisdom, rather than using 433.86 or whatever, they use 433.26 or whatever it is. But for the cost of about £4, you know, $4 or whatever, I got three of those sent over with the correct crystals, desoldered the crystals, put on the new crystals, and he's got like this, you know, a bunch of software that runs on the Pi that integrates with, you know, MQTT. And I had the whole thing up and running for £5 against an existing Pi. And I was just like, this is amazing. You just couldn't do this anywhere else. I was down for buying a separate bridge for £200, which probably used another load of, you know, probably 2 or 3 watts again. So I was trying to get away from that world. And it works perfectly. The blind still works on the remote if you want to override it. And then Home system just does its thing based on time of day, light, et cetera, what it does. So it's just, it just makes me smile on this whole pre and post. Yeah, you know, your decision-making criteria just changes radically when you've got to sort of see whether this is going to fit, whether it's the right color and what have. Trying to steer things, just trying to steer the conversation. I like this one. This is good.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Just on the remotes there, being 433 megahertz, do you know, does Home Assistant have like a live status update of what position the blinds are in? Like, does it know the blinds are open, blinds are closed? Can it tell that state, or it just sends it open?
No,
it's like halfway.
The
remote?
Well, the RTS, so it's a Somfy RTS blind. So I don't think it does, in that the remote doesn't either. You kind of, so the way the blind works is you set the top boundary, the bottom boundary, and then you have this thing called the Somfy place, which is like a fixed point somewhere wherever you determine. So you program that all in the remote. So typically what you'll do, you know, when the sun's at a certain level, it will just, you either press the, on the remote, you'd press the Somfy home button or whatever it is, which brings it down to that predetermined state. And then you can go up or down. And to be honest, that's, if I look at Home Assistant, it knows it's pressed the Somfy button. So it puts the blind in its position of half midpoint or whatever. But if I actually were to manually override it, I don't believe it would know that. So Home Assistant wouldn't know if you're like, I've dropped or risen the blind. But to be honest, we just leave it. We've got the rules set up, and we hardly ever use the remote just because it does everything. So it's worked.
Why would you need to? The only reason you would need to touch it is if you need to change the blind outside of your automations, which would be rare.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. But then you should. Or I was going to say, if the power goes out at some point, right? And then it resets its state, which nowadays isn't a problem anymore.
Yeah, except it's using MQTT for mine, so it's retaining state. So in theory, perfect, in a power cut, everything should remain as is. I know it's in theory, and pretty much it does, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
So we then moved on to presence, and I'll sort of, yeah, I'm kind of like, I have presence nailed now. I know it's the biggest headache for everybody. I've spent countless hours and what have you into doing that. So remember, I had a Pi in every room, pretty much all the living rooms or all the stuff that you really care about. And I had the connected alarm system. So I trigger lights based on movement from the infrared sensors to the alarm. So as you walk around the house, lights just come on as you go in. And you realize that those infrared sensors are absolutely rock solid. If you cross the beams, they work every single time. So I'm really pleased with that. The problem then is, of course, you've walked into a room, let's say we leave the lights on for 5 minutes. You've really got to move quite a bit then to re-trigger that infrared beam. And so we move into the real headache. And when I set this up, this was years before microwave sensors and all those things that we've got now. So I started to use Room Assistant first. So I don't know if you've seen that one. So, and that's
I still use that one.
Yep. And I spent a lot of time nailing down Room Assistant to be reliable in terms of checking when the cluster state is and resetting it automatically. So if you get into Room Assistant, go into MQTT Explorer and check the cluster state so that you'll often find if you've got quite a few nodes, they split themselves off into different clusters and then, you know, your state just goes all over the place. But I ended up, I don't know about you, Phil, but I ended up using Bluetooth Classic and it drives me nuts because, you know, BLE is so much better for presence, but I could not get any device to regularly keep BLE going. Because, like, if you do the iPhone thing, it just turns off in the end. Android did it as well. And so Bluetooth Classic works, and it works 90-odd% of the time, I would say, in terms of you have to really fiddle with the RSSI values to make sure it knows it's getting a signal from the right room. And I was pretty much there, but I still... sort of, I had the use case of, you know, sometimes my wife would decide to go into, say, into the dining room to read a book without a phone. I don't know who would do that kind of thing, but she went and did it. And of course, she's static in the room with no phone and the lights go out after 5 minutes or whatever. And a smart home starts to look like a really, really dumb home. Finally fixed that one. So there's another project I found, which essentially... I bought the £4 Raspberry Pi cameras, so I stuck them onto the machines that were already there doing the music, so they were already on and in. And it's basically in my case, a Docker container that you sort of run, which has got OpenCV in. So, and you tailor it, it's not doing any recording or anything. And if you look at the resolution of the camera, you can't really see any faces, but all it's doing is just detecting. It's detecting motion, and it's really good at detecting motion, just tiny sort of movements of head or anything. And so that's been, in combination with Room Assistant, I'd say I've finally nailed presence. But I haven't included one other part of that, which sort of moves onto the network, is the presence. So that's like room presence, keep the lights on presence. In terms of in home or not home, I've ended up using phones because we all carry our phones around. But I use, so the way I've done it is, the phones have fixed IP addresses. So like when you connect to your Wi-Fi, you do the edit, you give it a fixed IP address. So it always jumps onto the network, always on the same IP address. And then essentially I use the ping connector in Home Assistant to actually it pings. Yep. But the problem with iPhones in particular is they go to sleep. I found another sensor. I think it was on Hacks. I ought to really do it. It was ARP plus ping. And iPhones respond to ARP keeper lights, I think, essentially all the time. And again, that is absolutely rock solid. So for my wife and the two kids, I can guarantee to know whether they are in the house or not. 24/7, rock solid. So you've got a set of automations based on room presence and a set of automations based on whether somebody's in there. But I would recommend people looking as a mechanism of doing it, fixed IPs for the phone. So you obviously have to, you know, create a lease space in your DHCP setup, fix the phone so that when they jump on that, they have the same IP address. And it also solves random MAC address problems. So it just works and it's absolutely brilliant. So I would recommend that.
How have you found, in terms of other people in the house, having cameras, you know, like being used for the room presence. I know in my family, it's sort of, we don't want cameras looking at us, you know, in the home. Did you ever have any pushback? What about, you know, other people, like guests coming into the home? Have you had any pushback against that?
I haven't, but I'm not sure, I'm sure they've even noticed them. The Raspberry Pi cameras in there, they're tiny. So no, my kids just roll their eyes all the time and just go, oh, Dad, the Chinese are looking at us. You know, what are you doing, kind of thing. So I kind of get the derision on one half. And from guests and that, no. Never had any pushback, but it's not a kind of in-your-face thing. And if it was, I'd happily show them this thing isn't recording. It's just detecting motion.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm sort of pretty relaxed about that. And just as long as you yourself know what you're doing, you know, you're kind of fine with it in the end. I'm sure there are worse things happening out. Susie goes sort of out into public with what's happening with all the cameras.
Yeah, exactly.
So moving on from that, I then did the, so I had, you know, in a night of rage, I ripped, you know, everything went static, well, pseudo static IP addresses. And then I bit the bullet as well. Like, I really can't remember what kind of phase it was or what time it was, but I moved the whole thing across to YAML. So my everything, automations, and all of the UI as well, it's all YAML. And I think this was it's sort of interesting. I went to this because I was looking for, at the time at work, we were sort of, we had to learn DevOps, you know, because it was all the rage everybody was talking about. And I was thinking, what can I do here? And I suddenly realized I can flip the whole thing on and then I can do DevOps on it. So all of my configuration is in a repository. It's actually on an Azure private repo because at the time GitHub didn't have private repos and there was no way I was putting my repo in public because it's awful. It's probably full of keys and all sorts. But you could have a private repo there. So my development switch then, I use Visual Studio Code and it then, so I develop locally if you like, and then I commit and I've got a DevOps agent. So you can have these agents. So there's an agent on the Pi that's running Home Assistant and it basically then, it sees the commit and then copies it and then does a check. So the equivalent of when you're going to, you know, check the validity of the YAML that you've done, it does one of those, assuming it passes. It then does a HA restart and restarts the Home Assistant. So I've got kind of about, I think I've about 3,000 commits, something like that, on my Home Assistant development tree, if you like. But it was a really good way of actually learning sort of DevOps because it was, you learn by the mistakes, you kind of have to, you make mistakes and then you have to learn how to unpick mistakes and yada, yada, yada. And now I wouldn't be without it because you just make mistakes when you're doing stuff and I can sort of roll them back. Not that I ever do, I just go and fix them. But I have this history now of my sort of development of my own Home Assistant and it's backed up.
So does that mean every commit you do is like rebooting Home Assistant to like reload automations or reload the latest YAML?
I knew you were going to pick this up. So yes is the answer. And I know in the end, so I do a commit, okay, and it does a whole Home Assistant reboot, and that gives me the time for me to reflect on the wisdom of my commit, really, or the lack of wisdom commit. So, it can be a bit painful times because I've probably made a typo. You'll see quite a few. If you look at my commit history, there's quite a few typos. That's where I've just done something stupid, and that's cost me a few minutes in terms of the process of doing the whole reboot. And I know you could do it quicker, particularly when you're doing the UI development in Lovelace. But my Lovelace is pretty static now. I don't do much to it because I tried to make Home Assistant something that you don't use the UI for, if you like. So mostly I hope stuff just happens without actually having to do it. So it, you know, for me personally, it works really, really well. And I'm sort of comfortable with it. And I learned some, you know, useful skills, if you like, from my career at the time. And you know, if anybody else needs to get into DevOps and into Home Assistant, it's a really good way of learning it.
Mm-hmm. Have you thought about taking it to the level where you can detect, okay, in this commit, I only updated an automation. So instead of restarting Home Assistant, I'll just reload automations in Home Assistant to save the reboot time?
I thought about that, Phil. Yeah, I was waiting for you to write that bit and post it up so I can copy it.
Well, in all honesty, depending on what you're doing, if you're just triggering webhooks, right? Just say instead of running the restart, run the automation restart rather than Home Assistant. 100%.
I mean, it's even a bit, when you look at my tree, so everything's in directories. So I've got all the automation scripts, Lovelace. So it would be pretty easy to actually work out whether I've made, say, a Lovelace only change and then just fire. I don't know. I can't remember. So basically the DevOps agent gets access to, if you like, the HA core shell terminal. So I don't know if you can, from the command line in HA core, if you like, just do the sort of whatever the reload Lovelace thing is. Yeah. I don't know whether I've got access to that.
I think you might be able to even just do it. I don't know how you have your config set up, but you might be able to do it based on file modified, right? Like, so again, if, for example, if all of your automations are in automation.yaml, then
I can catch that bit for sure. I just don't know whether I've got access to only reload, you know, the automations or Lovelace or whatever.
Well, the Visual Studio Code add-on for Home Assistant, I'm sorry, we're paying a little bit of a tangent here, but the Visual Studio Code add-on for Home Assistant allows you to reload those certain bits through the UI itself. So that must be accessing the Home Assistant API. So if you could get a long-lived access token into your DevOps engine, you could probably just fire off a curl request to Home Assistant to say, okay, only automation was changed here. Now fire off this to the API to reload just automations. That would probably be your best way around it.
Okay, I'll put it on my list of things. And that's one I thought of, but never actually made the list.
Yeah, yeah.
How big is that list, just out of curiosity?
Does
it get shorter or does it always get longer?
It never ends. Let's put it that way.
Never ends,
it goes through phases of being short and long. But to be fair, I've been at this years now, and I am getting to the end of, I need to run a bit of hardware here to do something, or I need to run a cable. I would say I am at the end, nearly at the end. That's when you sort of get on to the, this is a stretch goal kind of thing, can I do this? We'll sort of move on to that as you sort of stuff. But I did the YAML, the DevOps stuff, as you discussed, and then I moved into the media remote phase. So I suddenly ended up, so we've all got Fire Sticks, whatever, you know, you got Roku, TVs, soundbars, blah, 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 blah,
everything,
whatever it is.
Everything.
And I decided at that point that I wanted everything to work within Home Assistant. So I embarked on this project of integrating everything. I bought some Broadlink IR devices. So anything that needs infrared, I can copy it and control it. And so essentially, if you sort of go into the room, so in my Lovelace, you go into the TV room or to the lounge or whatever, the first thing you'll see is basically a large remote, which is, you know, with all the buttons. So I can control, Home Assistant can control everything. It can play Netflix, it can do anything that the TV can do or you can do with all of those remotes together and play the volume, which then opens the door then for all the automations of, you know, which everybody does, you know, watching a movie, whatever it happens to be. So it was difficult to do just because of the sheer size, complexity, and catching IR signals and all of that. And it was even more nuanced later on. You know, when you get into the sound bar, you have to try and track how many times you need to press it to move the source to whatever. Yeah. And when you get in, so we had that, took quite a long time to bed down. And if I'm really honest, do we use it all? We use it for certain automations, for sure, but do we really use it for queuing up TV? No, the remotes are usually about, and it gets used when we can't find the remotes, is how it works. So, but you know, there are tons of other automations, like another one we got was the, I had the problem, and this is, Tasmos was fantastic in this one, of catching, you know, you turn the telly, so by default, the soundbar is configured to the Pi, so by default we're listening to music, so if there's music on, you walk into the room, turn the telly on, you need the sound bar to trigger to change source, which is a classic use case. How do you catch the use case of that? And I went through all sorts of, I started pinging the telly to recognize the telly had woken up, but that was too slow. Then the telly had some service, I can't even remember, it was some app on the telly, and it just never worked. It never worked in a way. And because I had plugs that monitor power within Tasmota, you can set a rule. So like by default, I knew when we were listening to music, the power was say 20 watts or whatever. But as soon as the telly fired up, it was, you know, above 75 watts. And at that point then, Tasmota just sends an MQTT signal. And I was there. And it was like there was this real light bulb moment of, it works. It worked 100% of the time. It never, ever fails. And so as soon as I turned the telly off, it then flipped, you know, the soundbar back to listening to the Pi. So, you know, for anybody who uses Tasmota and has got a power monitoring device, if you just sit and watch them, you can actually detect many, many different states. And you can get Tasmota. I forget what Tasmota is. Is it rules in Tasmota? Yeah, rules in Tasmota. And it was a real, you know, if we're all looking for making these things like smart, but really, really reliable.
Yeah.
That was one for me. You know, I had spent months and you'd all sit down and, you know, and then the kids would all roll their eyes as the telly, you know, as the sounds go into the wrong device or whatever. I'm going, hang on, I can sort this, you know. So it was just one, you're searching for those sort of, you know, this one really, really works. And that one worked.
You mentioned that you got the Broadlink devices. Did you get the Broadlink Pro that also does the RF frequency?
No, I went for the Mini 3s.
Yep, I was going to guess. My question was, could the RF, could you do the SOMA blinds with the Broadlink if you needed to?
I could have done, I think, but I just sort of didn't. And I had looked at them, and then because I was thinking, oh, do I need that to control the Fire Sticks? And I never actually got to the bottom of whether I did need them and whether they could, just because I realized I could control the Fire Sticks through the the Android debugger thing,
which best way to do it
worked fine. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I had a look. And I kind of discounted it, and I bought the Broadlinks before we got the blind kind of thing. So
yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, fair.
You're then fiddling around. So I also have, and we haven't described, but I have a polytunnel with irrigation systems in, and that was originally before we'd started doing Home Assistant. One of my other projects was that I'd got the Pis, and I have solar panels. So what I was trying to do was, years go by, I was counting LED blinks, so you know when you've got, and I could work out then roughly when I had an excess of electricity, and then I could use the borehole to turn on the borehole to do the irrigation. And it was back in the day, that was the Pis allowed me to do that, but that was based on, I don't know if anybody remembers, but there was actually a Windows 10 for ARM, the development stuff, so I could actually write this stuff in C#. I could actually... more important, I only went down this route because I had to be able to put breakpoints in the code and see it. And you're in this weird world of trying to get the code to work, but then like I'd be in the polytunnel and then like, you know, whatever time it was or whatever schedule, and I'd go, oh, that thing should be on now, and it wouldn't go on. Or more, you'd walk in and everything should be off and there's water pouring out of something. Mm. So you're in this sort of double world of really creaky software. And as soon as you transition from the software to the hardware, well, valves stick on, valves don't turn off. So you've got this, you're convinced, you know, your software's rubbish, and then it's just the valves got stuck.
Yeah.
But I had all of that, and I then decided, and it was actually Home Assistant sort of was responsible then for a switch to iOS. So we've all got iPhones now in the family, whereas I couldn't do before because I'd written the code and the app that I'd done was written in Xamarin, which was, and I wasn't going to pay $100 to Apple, if you like, to be able to just put the software on my phone. Just thought it's just not worth it. And I had another light bulb moment here when you think, I can actually put all of this into Home Assistant, and I can use the Home Assistant app to actually control it. So that was another huge project, if you like. So I switched everything, all the code. So I still left the code that was controlling the devices on the borehole and the polytunnel and the relays was custom C# code. But I then just switched it to MQTT so Home Assistant could just control it. So Home Assistant now controls all the schedules for the polytunnel irrigation. So we grow a lot in the polytunnel, and Home Assistant does that. And we might as well move on to the energy side of it. The other thing I have, and I'm sure this is probably country specific. So we upgraded to have some more solar panels on. And because of that, we have this stupid, bizarre rule in this country where you're allowed to export 4 kilowatts out back onto the grid without any paperwork. Mm-hmm. As soon as you go above 4 kilowatts, you then have to get a DNO, which is this certificate, which takes 45 working days to get after you filled in 28 pages of I don't know what. And I got I got a certificate back, which means I can export back 7.2, I think it was, which I was really disappointed with because it's kind of rubbish. Mm. And yet, so to put that in context, the house has 100 amp sort of fuse on it coming in off the grid. So even if you take like two kettles, you know, you boil this 6 kilowatts, isn't it? I can effectively only just put a bit more than two kettles back, but I can consume 100 amps off the grid. And no one will tell me why. You know, I would much rather push way more. I've got capacity now for more solar, but I can't put it in. But the problem with that is I now have a bigger capacity of solar than I do 7.2 to push back on a really, really, on the sort of the best summer days. So what happens is that the guys who install it have to basically install a sink. So as soon as I get to 7.2, if the house isn't drawing, you know, that, it basically sinks it. It just gets rid of it, which is madness. Yeah, so at that point now, Home Assistant can monitor when I'm getting close to 7.2. It turns everything on because I'm going to lose it anyway, which luckily I've got, you know, the borehole pump is 2 kilowatts. So I can, if I put the borehole pump on, that actually pulls me below the sort of, but Home Assistant is constantly monitoring this and keeping the pond topped up. Or if I'm in excess, it might as well do the polytunnel irrigation now because I'm going to lose that energy anyway, which is, it's like really, really cool. You know, this thing's monitoring what's happening on some solar panels, you know, what's going out onto the grid, and just turns on, you know, a bunch of valves so that everything gets. So the last bit I had was I am in my maintenance phase now of the system. So I've got a few projects on, but edge case manager we've sort of done. But I've moved to Kuma, so I tried out Kuma. I don't know if you've seen Uptime Kuma,
which is.
So that's been great. So I've got it. It was only because I didn't realize for ages that a camera had broke or whenever it was. Mm-hmm. So I just sort of. You know, it, again, if you're looking for that, and it's kind of interesting because I've taken it, I've realized that you can sort of fiddle around with it a bit. So, you know, we talked about Room Assistant. So it checks now. So it's looking at MQTT to check that Room Assistant, all the devices have got the correct, i.e. the same cluster leader name. And if it doesn't, it can just restart those instances. So before I even get the there's something wrong with Room Assistant, it's had its go at trying to correct it as well. So you sort of take it to the next level. And I sort of, some of the things I've been thinking about for Home Assistant, you know, in terms of the future, wouldn't it be, you know, great if they could put some of this stuff in? I was trying to think of how you could sort of, one of the things I was thinking about was, let's say you have a light or an entity, let's say it's a garage light or a porch light or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, we all do our entity. You know, you get up in the morning and you go, why is that light still? And then you realize it's been on all night because the edge case that you hadn't thought of has come and got you. And I thought, wouldn't it be great in Home Assistant if you could say on the entity, let's say you have a property that says if it's on for more than, say, 5 hours or whatever it is, turn it off. You know, you've kind of, and at the same time, if this edge case catcher or whatever you want to call it, sanity checker gets fired, you know, alert somebody to say, here's an edge case. Yeah. Because I was thinking this, I think it's impossible with all the interactions, and you sort of, the more bits and bobs you put into Home Assistant and the more connected it gets, you end up, you're on this exponential curve of complexity, and your chart, you kind of got to realize as you go down this journey, the more you put in, the more, and the more you kind of have cascading automations, because I have, you know, the gate will open, which sets the lights on, and you get these cascading things. You're just on an exponential curve. So you first of all, you've got to accept it, and then B, you're going to make mistakes, and then you just got to catch them when you can and put them in. It's just the way it works. But yeah, I'm sort of on that sort of things that could be that one alone. I was just thinking, oh, that would be great if you just do this on the entity. You say, have this thing.
So have you got Home Assistant to automatically repair itself? Like if it was to detect, okay, this cluster is at the wrong level now, let's go ahead. Like you said, you've got Uptime Kuma to do some of that, to reboot that. Do you have any of that powered in Home Assistant, or is it something else that's doing that?
No. So in that case, it is Home Assistant that's doing it. So I can't remember how you do it within Kuma. So Kuma, you just fire the web. So you fire a web hook.
Yep, yeah.
So Kuma detects in this instance that the cluster is the wrong name or something. Kuma detects this, sends a webhook to Home Assistant, and then within Home Assistant, I'm basically just sending restart commands over, you know, remote shell commands to do that.
Nice.
But that's kind of the start of that project. You realize, I think pragmatic solutions are the best ones here. You know, there's nothing makes a smart house look dumb more than I like going off when we're all in it and what have you. So the more you put in, the more you're going to have to spend over the years as well. Stuff just breaks. Stuff just happens.
Yeah.
So the trouble is we sort of all get into this fizz of excitement and we put stuff in and we kind of forget about it or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I'm at the stage where I've sort of got my list of things is getting shorter and shorter and I've spent some time really trying to make this thing, you know, really, really reliable.
Rock solid,
So I'm kind of getting there, but I'm not there at the moment.
Nice.
Uptime Kuma was a good start to do that.
Yeah, I think Jan mentioned that. In the last episode.
I'm sort of, getting towards the end of my list. I was going to go on to some of the things I haven't cracked yet. I haven't cracked the car arriving at the gate. I think I have. We have a bizarre situation where we have a really, really good broadband, but really, really bad phone signal. So if I'm using geotagging on the Home Assistant, by the time I get close enough, it's lost signal. It's got just in or out signal. So I've tried all sorts of things of trying to detect Bluetooth. I know like last week you were talking about doing number plate recognition and stuff. Just forget it. You just cannot do it. I tried. You cannot do it, let's say, in a timely manner. And usually you'll find that the cameras that you've got, if it's pitch black and pouring with rain, you've got no chance of getting that, you know. So I'm currently fiddling around with shortcuts in iOS, and you have to do all sorts of weird things to sort of get around some of iOS's stopping you to do these things, which is looking hopeful in that the phone recognizes it's, you create a different focus, the phone recognizes it's tagged into a different area, and it then uses one of the iOS shortcuts that you've configured through the Home Assistant integration. The problem then is I don't know which car I'm in to work out which garage door to open, but I'm getting there. I've tried all sorts of things, devices.
Could you use an NFC tag for this? Just have an NFC tag in the car.
I tried that one. So I've stuck an NFC tag on it. And the first problem is by the time I do that, I'm usually, you know, like I've got virtually zero signal. This is my problem. So the phone has no data signal. Great. And even then I found pressing the tag onto the iPhone, and I think the iPhone asks you whether you want to run this thing every time, which is kind of like pointless or something. So I think I've thought of everything, and I just, you know, for me, it's the holy grail of fixing that one. That's sort of my last one. I've also just bought the Open Energy Monitor thing. One of the things I haven't done is catch. I'm always worried about a pipe bursting, particularly with the outside stuff. And then if a pipe bursts there, the borehole is just going to run flat out 2 kilowatts and flood something. So the soldering iron was out again, and you get this little daughter board that you do. There's a guy on GitHub done those. So, and then I can actually detect, because one thing I can't detect at the moment is if that device has run away. I've just got no way of detecting the power that it's drawing. I mean, in theory, I could say, well, the house is doing something uncharacteristic because I could see that the house is drawing it, but I would have difficulty working out that it was actually
which
that.
One exactly so, it is.
So I've kind of got that one doing. And in the background, you know, for someone who's worked at Microsoft for a long time, I'm kind of going cold turkey that I'm working. I have an iPad now, and so I'm switching everything to iPad. So I'm trying to wean myself off PC just because I like the battery life on the iPad. Anyway, so I've got I'm using Code Server, so I don't know if you've seen that. So that's basically VS Code in the web.
Yep.
So they basically, I think it's the thing they use for code spaces on GitHub, same thing, but you can install it locally. So I've installed that on a Pi, and you know, you basically configure the iPad to just do a Safari window for that, and it looks like it's okay. So and there's enough tools around MQTT and, you know, SSH tools and what have you. So I'm sort of thinking I've finally broken free for the PC to be able to just maintain the whole Home Assistant through an iPad. It's a real shame that they don't do VS Code native for iOS, but I don't think it's ever going to.
No, I don't think coding on a tablet's probably their main target audience, I would say.
Oh, yeah. So, sorry, mine's an iPad Pro. So I bought the one with the keyboard.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
That would make
sense. I didn't realize they've gone to that level.
Yeah, yeah, I know. Which is, it's really, really good. And it's got a nice, so it is like using a PC, if you like, but it's got all day battery life and it's instant on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's...
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah, yeah. It's not the standard iPad experience of things. I've got a trackpad and so that's one of the things. I suppose sort of, yeah, I'm sort of at the end of my journey in that, you know, hopefully for some it's, there's been some good bits in there and pick out in terms of, you know, learn from our mistakes, you know, what we're going through and, you know, mine's a pretty complete sort of, I am at the point where I think I've done everything I can in the house. I've just got a few little projects to do, but essentially Home Assistant runs the house. It's getting very reliable. Mm-hmm. And it sort of makes you then ponder about the future of Home Assistant, the future of Nabucasa, because, you know, my view is I'm suddenly like really selfishly thinking, I need this thing to live on. You know, I can't, I know it's open source and what have you, but if the guys stop developing it, you know, I'm stuffed kind of thing. Because I've tried, you know, I sort of did everything I ever did in C#. And so I'm starting to try and transition to Python, but I'm not there yet. And I do look at some of the code now and again. It's painful. So I'm going to have to do that. But, you know, I hope... Yeah, firstly, I think Paulus, you know, what a job he's done to sort of create an open source project that is for consumers. You know, it's not like sort of Red Hat and stuff where they're doing it to enterprises. Mm. It's a project that is self-sustaining, you know, with a company in open source, which I don't think's ever been done before. So, you know, first of all, that's just amazing, let alone, you know, sometimes you start to think, you know, I walk through a house and the lights go on and you start to actually think what's happened there, you know, an infrared beam's been broken that's spoken to this, that's spoken to that, that's gone through a rule set and it's turned on a light. I think it's just, you know, and it's happening all around the world. So that, again, you know, I'm sure he must look about this as with some real pride in terms of what he's achieved here. So I just think we all need to sort of stand back because this hasn't, can't really think of another open source project that's got, you know, this... Any project that you do that integrates with everything is just going to be a nightmare from the beginning because you're going to get breaking changes and all the stuff that you've seen the project gone through. But it's growing and it's getting stronger, you know, and I just hope we can sort of move the project into being a bit more mainstream, but I don't know how we do it because a lot of the stuff we've discussed today, you know, a lot of people, even if they listen to this, they're like, oh, that's pretty geeky, you know, techie stuff. So maybe Matter is the solution to that. I don't know. Yeah. Or is that just another protocol that we're just going to have to deal with? So,
Time
I just
will
think
tell on that one. verdict's still out.
Yeah. I think I'm of the same opinion. We've all seen in the industry another protocol's just come out and it was another one to deal with rather than it being a solution to all the previous protocols that have actually happened. So I just, you know, I'd love to think that Nabucasa just, I don't know its sort of long-term viability, but, you know, personally, I just hope whatever happens there is a way there for Nabucasa to succeed because it kind of becomes essential, I think, to Home Assistant. We need people doing development on it full time as best, you know, people doing it part time is just never going to be sustainable, I think, as the project, you know, grows and grows.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think at least they have the right pieces there. So.
Mm. All right. Well, Alistair, thank you so much for talking to us today. We're going to leave some bonus clips on our YouTube channel. So if you want to check out some more with Alistair, links are in the description below. Elsa, thank you so much. We really appreciate you taking the time and thank you for all those tips as well.
Oh, a pleasure. And thank you for your time and thank you for your efforts on the podcast, guys.
You're welcome.
Cheers.
Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Cheers.
If you want to share your Home Assistant journey or come on as a guest, reach out to us at feedback@hasspodcast.io. That's hasspodcast.io.
The Home Assistant Podcast is hosted by Phil Hawthorne and myself, Rohan Karamandi. For links to topics we discussed today, check out our show notes on haspodcast.io.